I go for refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma, and Sangha, and all the answers to the moment, by the power of the goodness that I do, in giving and practice, may I reach Buddhahood for the sake of every living being. I go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, until I achieve enlightenment, by the power of the goodness that I do, in giving and practice. May I reach Buddhahood for the sake of every living being. I go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha until I achieve enlightenment. By the power of the goodness that I do, in giving and offering, may I reach Buddhahood for the sake of every living being. So we'll start with the meditation. So just close your eyes, settle your mind, and let all the busyness of the day fall away and not bring into mind anything that you have to do after class. You're just sitting here in a nice room with some nice people and in a nice place. There's nothing to worry about, nothing to think about. And just focus on your breath and bring all your winds down just by focusing on that single point of the breath as it enters and exits through the nasal passage. So take a moment to think about why you're sitting here, why you're trying to learn how to meditate. And call to mind one of the people that you've been thinking about lately, somebody who's in pain. And think about how you need to reach this goal of perfect happiness for them. So think about how this person and their pain is your projection, and therefore how you can't help them in any kind of way outside. And no matter how much we try to manipulate the world outside us, it doesn't actually work. We have to help them by changing ourselves from the inside. So we change ourselves, and we change other beings around us. So think about how little we understand that concept. Just go deep with the concept and just see how far you are from actually having any sort of grasp on the understanding that other beings are our projections. Imagine how getting into deeper and deeper states of concentration and being able to direct your mind more and more clearly towards that object and to understand that object. How that's really going to be the biggest help to you and everyone else. Okay. You can open your eyes. So, every time we meditate, we should start with calling to mind why we're sitting and meditating. That's what helps to take us further and deeper. So because it starts exciting because it's an idea that you have that you want to do this, and then down the road you forget and you haven't been training your mind to remember, and so either you just stop or you stop making progress or you just simply forget why and then you just stop doing it altogether. Just a million different things why, but this is how we cultivate a long relationship in meditation. It's something that we incorporate into our lives. It's not something that we do with our own, you know, with our spare time. Oh, I have an extra 30 minutes here. It's like we plan for it. We make it part of our day. And then you have to decide for yourself and figure out when that best time to be is. Actually, we talk a little bit about how the time of day is affected in your body at the end of class. So we have to keep that in mind because we need to keep our effort, right? Because we're not going to make any progress without any effort. So that's important to understand. It is simply just like anything else. So it's like learning how to do anything, right? So you have to remember why you love playing the piano, if that's what you love, or why you like to do anything in order to keep it. So it's not like meditation is any different than anything else. But you have to stay mindful of why we're meditating. I like, you know, meditation, I think I'm finding out these days, I don't actually like the word meditation. It's become like a word that means work to me. It's funny, like I used to do things very naturally without even anything. I'd do my yoga every day, I'd meditate, it's no big deal. But then somebody told me I had to, you know, because like I had to reach this goal. And it was cool at first, but then the word became synonymous with work. And so I'm getting more into the idea of prayer. And because I was reading, I'm going to Allsfeld this weekend to see, in English they call him John of God. He's a Brazilian medium who he always says it's not me who does the healing, it's the entities that come through him. But it's like a lot of talk about spirituality and God. And so I had to read the website because you have to prepare for this. And the one thing that they really, they have, meditation is huge. And believe me, it's all the same. It's all about surrender. It's all about acceptance. It's all about like opening your heart, right? So Buddhism and Christianity or anything that's happening at this thing this weekend, it's all part of like the bigger picture of like opening ourselves up. But it was interesting because one of the things it said that prayer is meditation, or silence is prayer, or silence is meditation, or something like that. I don't know, I read this thing and I was just like, oh, that just sounded like silky. So I said, oh, I gotta change. And I do this every so often. I change my words around. It's the same thing. It's just what it means to me, and this is what making your practice your own is. And it doesn't mean that my word is the same word you guys, you know? But you know what I mean? Like, I think I've mentioned in this class, like, I like the word grace. Oh, my friend who's Spanish, you know, she likes the word grace for bliss, you know? And I like the word grace, too. And I like to think of when I'm sitting in meditation as sitting in grace, you know, in this, like, spaciousness of, like, the divine. And then I'm like, oh, then it doesn't feel like work. Then it feels relaxing. My mind calms down, and I don't really have to work so hard, actually. It just kind of feels like all the pieces fall into place, you know. And so I'm just mentioning that because today's class is all about the kind of nuts and bolts of meditation and about agitation and dullness, kind of how you go through the 9 levels of meditation. And I found out after many years that I was actually way more agitated than I thought I was. I found out that my mind was really, I was holding on to the idea of what the goal of meditation can bring so tightly that there wasn't the clay that I needed to knead the dough. And I thought I had more dullness, actually, because I would sit and kind of feel sleepy. But that wasn't actually, I mean, of course, I still had dullness, but it's always this balance in meditation between dullness and agitation. And then we have to do these antidotes, and then you know work your way into this middle space where you don't have that anymore, and you know only you know when that happens. So that's where we're at in the Bhavana Krama, right? Master Kamala Shila in the last couple classes has been really talking to us a lot about Bodhisattva activity and bodhicitta, well, really bodhicitta. It's really been all about the wish for enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. And so, you know, remember he came and did his skillful means with us, and he said, oh, you don't have to do any actions of a bodhisattva. You just have to have this wish in your heart to help all people, you know? And the tricky thing is that once you have that wish, then you want to do things for people. And so, so it's kind of cool. So bodhicitta breaks down into two aspects, munpesam and shukpesam. And munpesam is the wish in the form of prayer, right? In the form of a prayer. And shukpesam is the wish in the form of action. Shuk means to enter into something, okay? It's this feeling of like throwing yourself into something. So munpesam, the wish in the form of a prayer, and shukpesam, the wish in the form of action, okay? So the prayer is, you know, that wish that you could take care of all beings. And then the activity form, the action, is the actual doing of things. And the doing is infinite. I mean, we're all doing things all day long. So that could be, that is bodhisattva activity. And if you think of it as bodhisattva activity, then they say that the basically the merit, the karma of it is much quicker. Like that's why we don't just want to do things because we think it's the nice thing to do. That's more the attitude of I'm doing it to be nice so that other people like me, you know. But this is more of an attitude as I'm going to do it because it's the right thing to do, and because not only the right thing to do in the moment, because it is the nice thing or the correct, it's the correct thing to do. And sometimes that can look very different, you know, than what you thought it could look like. And I warn this because sometimes, you know, our pride steps in the front, and we think we're doing the right thing, but really we're just still trying to get people to like us. And then I have some pretty harsh language. It's not harsh. I wouldn't call it mean harsh. It's like, it would be typical if you were from where I'm from. But we have this saying where you shove things down people's throats. and it's a very common saying. But now that I'm in another place, it sounds so intense. but it is kind of intense. I've tried to do this before where I'm constantly trying to help. Like I have this friend, I'm trying to help her. But I realize I got to stop. It's no longer a bodhisattva activity. It's now becoming harmful because she is totally annoyed, and she like stops wanting to hang around with me, you know. So I realized that I keep thinking I'm trying to fix it out here. I was like, okay, she's teaching me. I need to fix it inside, just like when we were talking about in the meditation. So that's just something to consider when you're thinking about your like holy bodhisattva activities. So we've talked a little already in a couple classes about more of the prayer, the wish in the form of a prayer. You know, that was the part that led up to the skillful means. So now we're going to talk a little bit about the activities of a bodhisattva. And in the reading, he mentions the six perfections, the four immeasurables, and taking on students, which, you know, Lama Christie, what she taught, it didn't really go into that. But the six perfections and the four immeasurables I can certainly talk about. The six perfections there's certain people in this room who got these six perfections again this weekend, and who some even have printed on their T-shirts and want to sell those T-shirts or give them away. So they must know them by now. All six of the six perfections. Anyone?
Giving.
Yeah, giving.
Kindness. Yeah, kindness.
Morality or kindness.
Patience.
Joyful effort.
Meditative concentration
and?
Wisdom.
And each of the six perfections lead into the next. So we start with giving.
dhyana in Sanskrit. And the reason we start with giving is because, well, that's what we're doing all day long. We're giving of our time, we're giving of our money and our clothes or whatever material possessions, our food. You know, I mean, if somebody walks in the house, oh, do you want some tea? I mean, that is technically giving, you know. We're doing it all day long. I mean, every day you feed me. I mean, seriously, these extraordinary meals. I mean, I hope that you're dedicating that goodness, both of you, because you may buy it, but he participates. Mm-hmm. It's teamwork. Mm-hmm. And so giving gets us up on the upper spiral, because we're giving our time. We're giving our material things. They say one of the other aspects of giving is protection from fear, which I think is really cool. I think that that's a really strong one, especially for children, right? You're trying so desperately to give your kids like this protection from fear. But I think we do that with everybody that we're close to. You know, I think we would give anything for the people close to us not to feel like they had to fear anything. You know, I know my family, it's the same way. You know, it's especially in our immediate families. And then, of course, with our close friends. And as we've learned in this class, too, we're trying to throw the lasso around more people. You know, like I went to Gertrude's birthday party on Saturday night. And I could see it was cool because of the way you designed the tables and everything in your living room. I could see, like, the lasso around, like, there was, like, this group of people. And everybody was eating together, and it was such a sweetness, you know, when people eat together. And, you know, you're closer to some than others, and you know different people. You know, when you have these, like, engagements at your home and you're entertaining. You know, we know people in different aspects of our lives, you know. And, like, we're closer to some than others. And then for this moment, you know, you're taking care of all of them, you know, because they come into your home and you're the host or the hostess. And it was just kind of cool because she had the table set up in such a way I could act, well, because we were in four walls. But it was cool because I could kind of see it. I could see it. And it was sweet. And so it gave me some insight into how we do that, you know, just in our daily lives. I scrolled too far. So the six perfections, so giving, I mean, I could talk for weeks on the six perfections alone, by the way. It's a whole path to enlightenment in itself, because giving, and then giving the Dharma or the truth, or, you know, giving some wisdom to people, you know, anything, you know, if somebody comes to you in search of help for something, that's like the highest form of giving. And then that gets you on the upward spiral where you have the concentration to be able to keep your morality. Mm-hmm. And that's why Geshe-la translates it to kindness sometimes, because it's a great kindness, right, to be keeping your morality, you know. And in Christianity it's the same thing. And to be honest, I don't know anything about the Jewish religion, don't know anything about the Muslim religion, so it's not, it's just because I only know Christianity. In Buddhism. So it's cool because, you know, they're both very strong spiritual paths, and they both have very strong roots in morality. And, you know, it's the same, not killing, not stealing, no sexual misconduct, no lying, no divisive speech, no harsh words, no craving ill will, and no wrong worldview. So it's really quite beautiful. And so then you start to keep this morality, you know, really with wisdom. And then it gives you the ability to have patience, right? And patience in this sense is really in the face of adversity, not reacting. So the closest word Geshe Michael could come to in English was patience. So language can be very restricting, but it's like when a situation arises and you don't react to it in a negative way, that's going to come back at you in the future as something negative. So it's not getting angry in the face of anger, for instance. And then that allows you, in patience, we all, and right, I pray for patience a lot. And that allows us to the next perfection, which is joyful effort, right? And joyful effort is not just effort, right? It's joyful effort. It's being joyful in the effort that you that you do, right? So even if there's effort that you're making on a daily basis, like our jobs perhaps, you know, we want to find the things within that that make us joyful for us. But this is more like along the lines of any sort of these goody two-shoe, that's another common phrase in the U.S., this like goody-goody attitude that we, this holier-than-thou attitude that we might take, but sometimes we do it because we feel obligated and then there's no joy in it. And it's better not to do it. And like in the Buddhist law, the way things work, they would say, like my teacher would say, well, he would say, don't do it then. And it wasn't because, you know, it wouldn't be like, well, don't do it then. It would be like, don't do it because you're not doing yourself or anyone any good, but actually you're harming yourself by doing the activity with a negative mindset. So it's better to not do the action if it's going to cause you mental affliction. You have to be really in tune, or you get through it and then you do the activity and you find the joy in it. Letting go of a big project, especially for like, you know, like, is hard. Your ego is, because your ego is attached, because you feel a sense of identification. We sometimes feel an identification with ourselves through the good work that we do. And, like, I've had to give up projects because, simply because I did not have the mental capacity to handle it and have a good attitude about it. And it was hard because I was like, this is what I do. Like, oh my God. I was completely mentally afflicted. And so I let it go. And it was a really good, see, it's funny when these things come around. That was the best opportunity I had to actually see my ego, because I struggled with it. Do you know what I'm saying? It's hard for us sometimes to get in touch with the ego. But this was a good one because I was so burnt out, you know, and I really didn't want to do the project, but there was part of me that didn't want to let it go. And I was like, oh, there it is. Oh, and the ego in the sense of like grasping to this, it's not like the ego is just like, separate thing. This ego is just attachment and this thinking that I am this other thing. Like the project, the way people perceive me don't define who I am. We have to be careful, and that's something, you know, that this practice will help us to get in touch with better. You know, because the world around us wants to define us. We dealt with this at the lunch table today. The world, like with insurance or whatever, you know, the insurance people didn't want her to say something because they knew they were doing it out of kindness, because the doctor knew that in the future it would be harder. But at the same time, you can't lie, because see, that's the ignorance of our culture keeping us in samsara. It's sick and it's twisted. And we think that it's going to get us what we want. Like the bank robber thinks that getting away with stealing $100,000 is what caused him to have a nice life in Mexico, you know, sipping the umbrella drinks. But that's not actually the case. The pleasant feeling came from doing his, when he did pleasant good things. But the stealing is never going to bring pleasant. Just feels like it does sometimes, and it seems like it does. Just like, you know, lying on a receipt for, this comes up all the time in samsara, by the way, in our lives. These regular little tiny things come up all the time. Oh, I felt like I traveled internationally this summer, and, you know, when you go to the border, they're like, well, what are you doing here? And I was like, well, I'm visiting friends. And I was! It wasn't like I was lying, I just didn't tell the whole story. And it was what my lama had told me to do, so I felt, I was like, oh, that's cool. He's like, just tell them you're visiting friends, that's exactly what we're doing, you know. And we're making new friends. But, you know, it's a funny thing. But I questioned it, I was like, so I had to really get straight in my head, like, I was visiting friends. Friends were picking me up from the airport, I was staying with friends. So I didn't lie. So that is joyful effort. And then joyful effort, see, each one allows us up into the next one. And then from joyful effort, we go into this space of being able to have meditative concentration. Because at this point we understand so much, we're having joy in doing all these good deeds. And that means that when we sit down, our mind isn't so consumed by its impurities. Because we've done all this cleaning. This is all cleaning. We were cleaning house. And then we sit in meditation, we have this meditative concentration, which brings us to that platform we've talked about in this class of being able to see emptiness directly, and that's number six of the six perfections. It's the perfection of wisdom. And that is the real perfection of wisdom. We're talking about the perfection of wisdom. We've perfected wisdom. So there it is, the end of the line. So it's pretty cool. Four measurables I won't go into so much, but it's this really beautiful. It's Maitri, Karuna, Mudita, and Upeksha in Sanskrit. It's this beautiful idea that, you know, we say we have four aspects of these four different things. I want everybody to feel love. So those are love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. Maitri, Karuna, Mudita, and Upeksha. It's the real Series 3 in Tibetan Heart Yoga. She did a very avant-garde version.
Love,
we didn't.
Compassion.
So it's Maitri is love. Karuna is compassion. Mudita is joy. And Upeksha is equanimity. So can you see how those four things are also a path to enlightenment? But it's not just the four things. We have these four thoughts about those four things. I wish everybody could feel love. I'm going to do whatever I can to make sure everybody experiences love because I can. And then it's like, wait a minute, I'm not going to wait for anybody else to help me. I'm going to do it, even if I have to do it myself alone. And then we ask for help from our teachers. Then it's cool because then you're like, oh, I need help. So you do that about all four things, about love, compassion. May all beings feel compassion. May I be able to help them. I'll help them even if I have to do it by myself alone, and then ask your teacher for help. And you go through love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. It's really, it's a very powerful bodhisattva activity. The activities are wrapped up within these four immeasurables. It's really interesting. And people's suffering is a projection coming from our own minds. And the only way that we can stop that projection is by working from the inside out. Right? And our activities are working from the inside out. So, like, you can use any example of an activity. I'll just use the example of, like, something simple, like me teaching this class. So, I come to Germany, and I teach this class, but I do not know what you hear. I could talk until I'm blue in the face, and I don't know what you guys hear, because the reason that I would be here would be... for myself to plant a seed in my own mind of seeing myself planting seeds in other people's minds where they're with the understanding that that seed will ripen and that will take us all, that will take them out of suffering. It's funny, right? It's dramatic too. Come all the way over to Germany. So it's funny how the seed planting thing works. It doesn't work. Like me just sitting here and talking, believe me, I know that doesn't work. but it's how I perceive myself, seeing you guys. And then I see you guys happier and happier. And it's funny, but that's how it works. And you'll do it with your friends, like you do the Tonglen practice. And then they call you up and they're like, I don't know, something weird happened and I'm happier today. And you're like, oh my God. That's a great practice if you want to see. I don't know. It happens for a lot of people that practice works. And then we feel like we're doing something because we feel kind of hopeless. You know, sometimes we feel like our hands are tied and that we can't help somebody that we love so much and that's having a lot of problems. All right. So this is doing bodhisattva activity with our minds, you know? It's that awareness that everything is planting seeds for the future. You know, it's how I'm creating my world. I'm creating it in this moment, but it will ripen in the future. Because only we can only experience in the moment. We're always experiencing just the moment. It's amazing, though, how our minds are, like, thinking about the future and the past. They say that's what keeps us in suffering. It's really, it's not being able to keep the mind in the present moment. It's pretty wild. And there's only a few people, I think, on the planet that really can teach how to stay present. But it also comes down to you just practicing it. Just trying to keep your mind focused on what's happening and not wandering off into something else. Future hasn't even happened. I know it's happened to all of us where we've, like, had thoughts, like, about the future. And especially when it's, like, we're nervous or have a lot of fear. And then the thing happens, the future comes, that present moment comes, and it doesn't go anything like you had expected it was going to go. And you spent all that time worrying. Mm-hmm. I can literally feel the prana being sucked out of my life. Like, they say you only have a certain amount of life force energy in your body. And, like, when I do that, I can literally feel it being sucked. I can feel it sucking out of my body and causing wrinkles. So, like, I really think that if you can practice staying focused on the present moment and calm, you know, and when you do all these activities of a bodhisattva, it's actually possible to stay calm in the moment, even when something crazy is happening. I see it happened to me today. I saw it in somebody else, so I knew that was coming from me. Somebody's life just exploded. I saw exactly that was going to happen. So I was not surprised. Somebody's life exploded today. Nobody's hurt, nobody's harmed. It's just like, you know, when you know something is going to have to break, you can't just continue living a certain way, and you just see it in somebody else. And so this person comes to me and told me, but then said, I don't feel upset and I don't feel happy. And, like, this person was confused, but not confused at the same time. Because in the ordinary way of thinking, you would think that person would be sad. Certainly not happy. But do you see there was no relief? I mean, there was relief, actually, almost. There was just this sense of, it just was what it was. And then what sprouted was just kind of love and compassion. It was funny. And for the first time in this person's life, I think that they started to get, like, life isn't black and white. Because in a regular life, right, we're, like, we think we're supposed to be upset when somebody dies. That's just the way it is. That's life. We're supposed to be upset when someone dies. But that's not true. We all know that. We just experienced it. You know, it can be joyful, too, because everything is born and everything dies. And does it always have to be such a Shakespearean tragedy? Because then we spend a lot of effort coddling ourselves through the emotional drama of this experience. It doesn't mean that we don't get sad, or, you know, we still feel things. But we understand that that's not what defines us or that situation. It's okay. It's like, you know, sometimes we cry when we didn't expect it. You know, we have an emotional, it's the same thing. It's like, I remember my aunt died, and I still haven't cried. Oh, I did a little bit. But I was so busy taking care of the details of her death that there was no time. There just simply was not time to grieve. And my mom and I was with my mom and my dad, and it was my mom's sister. And you'd think that she would be a wreck, but she wasn't. She was strong, and she was focused, and she was clear, because she wasn't thinking about herself. She had to take care of her sister, oh my God, now I'm going to cry. She had to we had to take care of her. Even though she wasn't alive, she died very suddenly. Very suddenly. And she still had, she rented a house. She had an apartment rental. She owned a house. She had a car. She had bills that needed to get paid. She had bank accounts. She had friends. We had to take care of everything. And I went through every step of the way with it. We had friends coming over to her house. A mess. Their friend died. And we couldn't be crying too. That wasn't what was going to help them. You know, we had to stay strong. And it was funny because it was the most natural thing in the world. And me and my mom and dad talked about it. We were like, this is such a weird phenomena. Because you don't know that that's what's going to happen. But we just were so busy and so, she was so present for us that it wasn't like she died. You know, we saw her body and everything. It was so weird. Yeah. And I just remember thinking, oh, you aren't supposed to do anything. There's no supposed to's. And we have to let go, you know, not feel guilty if we don't cry. Then I tried to make myself cry afterwards, and it just wasn't time. You know, I see people that look like her all. I saw somebody just the other day, and I was like, God. It's like her doppelgangers live. So it's like she lives, because she lives here. And every time I see somebody that looks like her, I'm like, that is her. Because she didn't die. She just changed forms. And if I think anything less, then I'm cheating myself out of the reality, which is that she didn't die. She just stopped existing in her physical form for me, just like Shanti, you know? And so now I can still hear her teaching me, and I can still experience her, even in a physical way, because I swear to God, I saw her the other day. Lady had the haircut and the nose and the color and everything. Yeah. Life is not so black and white. And all this bodhisattva activity and this intention and motivation that fuels it, which is the define. It's like what makes bodhisattva activity is the motivation behind it. And when we care more about others, then we tend to have a different relationship to the moment at hand. And then all the things that our society defines us, is trying to define us as, starts to fall away and fall apart, because you have a direct relationship with that moment, and you're like, wait a minute, I didn't feel that at all. You know, just because somebody yells at me, I don't have to yell back, huh? And that's breaking down the fabric of reality. Okay, I hope that makes sense to you guys. It's just that the mind is very used to reacting all the time. It's used to, and then we feel bad sometimes when we don't. But we're not defined. But this bodhisattva activity is getting us to, I guarantee you, if you practice these things, you will be you probably are calm now. I don't know. But it's just that you come from the present moment with clarity and with beauty and grace. And it allows us to help so many more people. All right, so that's bodhisattva activities. But the main bodhisattva activity is to get ourselves to enlightenment as quickly as possible. Because that is what the best benefit for others is. So I'm going to clarify a little bit, because I think that this idea of enlightenment is really kind of weird. What am I talking about? What is Master Shanti Deva talking about? What is Master Kamala Shila talking about? Enlightenment is the idea that we are free of all the things that make us unhappy or sad or uncomfortable or pain or in pain. See, the way that Buddhism explains it is that we're born with what we call the five heaps. It's just five parts that make up a person. And what's included in the five heaps is feelings heaps, consciousness heaps. So it's all about mind and physical, all your physical parts, your heart, and your lungs, and your bones. I mean, really, the physical, gross physical stuff, you know? All the way up to our consciousness and our feelings. So it's all mental. It's mostly physical with some mental, or mostly mental with some physical. I can't remember. And why we feel pain and discomfort and sadness is simply because those heaps are impure. They've been impure since beginningless time, because we cannot point to a time when time begins. So as far as Buddhism is concerned, once you get out of suffering, that's it. Like, you don't go back to suffering. Because you understand how everything works, all the secrets are they have unfolded before you. So enlightenment is this freedom from these it's turning your impure heaps into pure heaps. And so you can see how, I can see when I talk about bodhisattva activity, how it changes the mental heaps. And the mental and the physical are very much connected. And so if you purify your mental heaps and your consciousness heaps and all that, it will turn your body into a pure being. And so that's why you don't have to, you can actually, I mean, that's why there's people who've lived for hundreds of years on the planet, and most of them are in the East, because that's where they teach you how to do this stuff when you're a baby. So I'm very interested to go there and actually physically experience this body in that place where people are. I have a friend, Julia, who went to Tibet and was teaching children. And she met a woman who was like 165 years old or something like that. I don't know. She was like really old. And yeah, I mean, people like that exist. You know, that's not even that old in the grand scheme of things. So anyway, because death itself is a transformation. So we transform, if we transform the way we perceive death, then it's no longer the death that maybe all of us are dealing with now, which is the death from the gross physical body. Where? So, but that's enlightenment. Enlightenment is this shift in the mind's perceptions. And it transfers into the body. I mean, it's the way that, it's how Jesus could come back to life from the dead. He understood that it wasn't a death, necessarily. I have a lot of theories about the Jesus thing. But it's kind of cool, because Christianity actually talks about it. But it's, alright, so as bodhisattvas, our main activity is to get enlightened. So it's to remove our own suffering so that we can truly help other beings. And we do this simply by doing these steps. I mean, the name of this book is Bhavanakrama. It's the steps of meditation. It's just like a lot of the other books in Buddhism, it's literally follow these steps and you will take yourself to this place of enlightenment. And it isn't a place that you go, it's a place here that lives inside of us all. So we're basically removing the impurities and just then living in a pure state of being. So that takes us to this idea that we need to prioritize because there's only so much time in the day. And this becomes this becomes like your art project. You know, your life, it's your palette. And and that's how I like to look at my life. It's like this palette, you know, it's a blank screen and I color it every day. And, you know, not that I'm forcing any colors onto the screen, it's almost like I just kind of observe. But mostly I'm just trying to do bodhisattva activity with that frame of mind. And I find, because I've been testing this theory out for about 8 years, that it really does work. The colors that I see on the palette are very beautiful, and they very much suit, you know how we all have different colors that we're suited to? I think that's fun, you know, we always kind of look at people and like how they dress in different colors that they wear. They're very suited to those colors. So it's like you paint your own palette to the color scheme that you're suited for. You know, so your bodhisattva activities might look different than someone else's, but it doesn't even matter because it's all in your own mind anyway. It's just how what your motivation, your intention is when you do whatever you do in the world. I mean, it doesn't matter. So this is when your life becomes, you know, a piece of art. And then we look at our, you know, our minds and we see how we can further ourselves on the path, right? So if you study and you start to understand karma and emptiness a little bit, then you can tell the karma that you might need to accumulate or work on simply by looking at your own practice. For instance, if you, and that's what the motivation, the meditation journal is for, and your six times a day book, these are really good ways to see the patterns in our lives. Because I don't know about you guys, but I certainly have patterns, reoccurring experiences that I have. And I know, I finally get to a certain point after like the 50th time, or the second, depending, where I'm like, oh, I really need to address that, you know? And so I think, okay, what are the karmas that I need? Well, one, what are the karmas that I keep recreating to see this in my world over and over and over again? And then I think, okay, and then sometimes it takes some detective work and even asking some, you know, people that might know, might be able to help you. And then I figure out the karmas that I can do to not just the ones that you stop the karmas that you need to stop recreating, and then, you know, maybe there's karmas that you want to get into, you know, like a simple karmic correlation. I know you guys do not have it here, but clearly most, if you see where you live as a beautiful place, then you have created a karma of living in a beautiful place. It was funny, at your birthday party, I was talking to Peter, and we were talking about this wonderful place called Vitasburg, you know. And, but when you look at Vitasburg under a microscope, you start, you know, you can talk about, it's funny, like, but we were talking about all these were like the total minor things, like, but then there, you see how there were a lot of things, and it's like, as your life gets peaceful, like the smells of the manure, or, I don't know, apparently there's a kid in the neighborhood who uses this plastic thing to roll around on. They were trying to explain it to me. I finally got it. That makes a lot of noise. What else? There's a couple other things, but they were so silly, you know? And it was really funny. But, like, you could make these your big things. Like, if you had the karma for that to be a problem, then that's a problem. But, like, he was pretty chill about it. I mean, like, he was telling me that him and Corinna had to change their sheets one night because the manure smell had gotten into their sheets. And I was like, wow. I wonder if that would have been my limit. But he said they love living here. You know, they think it's a very special place. And I can see how someone else might be like, that's it. That's the final straw. We're out of here. I know people that much prefer to live in the city. So, like, that would be, like, a knife through the heart for them to have to change their sheets because, you know, it was summertime and they had the windows open. So it's just kind of funny. It just shows you that, like, your karma ripens for beauty, but it can also ripen for, like, funky smells. Like, this place is very, my senses are so heightened here, and I don't know, it's mostly beautiful, so I can't really say, but today I smelled the manure, and I was like, oh, it's funny how it smells different every single day. There's so many smells here, it's unbelievable, and I like it, it's endearing, and it's comforting, you know, because I like it here, but you can see, you know, like, so if I wanted to stop the manure smells, okay, I come home with Daya one day, and I was like, oh, smells like poop today, and she goes, what? She did not smell it at all. Not even at all. She's like, it's like, I don't smell anything. And I was like, holy, yeah, let's say holy crap. But holy cow, I couldn't believe it. I was like, really, you can't smell that? It's so funny. But this to me is exactly what we're talking about here. It's the karma thing. So there's very specific karmas related to, like, smells. and like the world that you experience around you. And it's just interesting because if you want to know what you have to do to make your world beautiful and perfect, you just look at your world around you, and only you can do it for yourself. Like, you can't ask somebody else because they have a different relationship to the world around them. And then you can go find the karmic correlations, which I think is a wonderful ACI course because you get to, it's kind of fun because when you learn karmas and their specific correlations, you can really start to practice this, and it's fun. All right, so a point to make an aspect of bodhisattva activity, and specifically using the example of the six perfections, you can go around and giving and give and give and give and give. Oh, give until you're broke. Give until you don't have any clothes in your closet. Give all your time away and not have anything happen. Because you won't reach the perfection of giving until you get the idea of doing the giving as an activity that's going to get you enlightened to help other beings. So that's important that you understand. It's, again, the distinction between doing things just for the sake of giving, like to be a nice person, and doing things specifically to help other people. His Holiness the Dalai Lama calls it enlightened self-interest, because I think that sometimes we feel guilty when we think that we're doing this thing to get ourselves enlightened, but it's actually the kindest thing that we could ever do for someone else. To get enlightened is literally the kindest thing you can do. The kindest. So, it's not something that should make you feel guilty. It's something that should make you really, really want to do that sweet thing, that kind giving. I am doing this to get enlightened because I know that it's the only way that I can truly help people. It's funny, but that's like the biggest thing I encounter with people. And it makes sense. We are so, because samsara is so intensely the opposite. Like, we feel guilty and we feel bad. And that's what we're trying to remove. We're trying to remove all that negativity. And we do it because we want to really help other people. Because that negativity, it hurts. You know, and it doesn't even mean that you have to give things away, you know. It's, the perfection of giving is pretty, really powerful. That's why it's the first one, and it leads to being able to keep your morality. So that's just something maybe you want to think about. Yeah, but it's good. All right, so now we're going to do the second meditation. So,
take a few seconds, minutes to
take a little break. Move your body around. I'll take a sip of my now lukewarm tea. So sometimes I think I just make it and then I never drink it. That's why I like microwaves. Just one aspect to warm your tea up. Okay, so sit nicely with a straight back. And just focus on the breath as it enters and exits through the nasal passages. Now think about the activities that you normally do during your day. So just literally go through in your mind what makes up an average day for you. Like waking up, brushing your teeth, that kind of thing. And as you're going through the list, think about how many of those things that you do during the day, according to the definition of bodhisattva activity, how many of them actually are bodhisattva activities? So how many of your actions during the day are helping people? And if so, in what way are they helping people? So think about how the ones that, the activities that maybe weren't so bodhisattva-like could become bodhisattva-like in your mind. Now picture yourself already a bodhisattva and see how your mind goes through your day. Okay, you can open your eyes. So with this meditation, you have a constant awareness of your world, right, as you go through your day. And it's always going to be the intention more than the actual action itself, right? Because when we're talking about bodhisattva activities, we go as far as to say going to the bathroom. Can be a bodhisattva activity. So it's like Did you go there in your meditation? Did you think, oh, and then I went to the bathroom? And then how do you make that of a Bodhisattva activity? So how do we get to the concentration throughout the day, right? To keep our minds focused on our intention. And then in the reading, there's a text by Lobsang Chukyi Gyaltsen, who's the first Panchen Lama. And that's how we develop. He's going to teach us how to develop that ability, that concentration, to keep our minds focused on our intention. And this is, these are the 8 obstacles and 5 antidotes to meditation. This is a very classical and necessary presentation. In the ACI courses, it's found in Course 3. So the first obstacle is simply not wanting to meditate. This is like my biggest obstacle. I just don't want to. It's not laziness. It's not the laziness. It's literally the not wanting to. Those are 2 totally different things. I only wish I was just lazy. And that's why I have to always make it my own. Like, I have to connect to it spiritually. I have to connect to it somewhere. Like, yeah. Otherwise, I don't want to do it. So that is the first obstacle, is that not wanting to meditate. Right? So basically, during this class, Master Kamala Shila has just been giving us meat for why we should want to meditate. He's been trying to get us to that space, you know, to that place of compassion in us where we have this understanding that we could really help people if we did become very good meditators. And it's true, because meditation helps you to be more focused and more concentrated and simply allows you to be very good at a lot of things in the outside world. So it's amazing, because people will come to you and you'll have some clarity about, without emotional attachment, simply because you meditate. Meditation has so many benefits as a human being. It's amazing. And if you just go online and Google it and you see the ridiculously long list of things, I mean, it basically cures every, if you look, it's funny. I've done that a bunch of times. Like, I like to see what the regular world is talking about with meditation. And like, they'll list out everything. And if you look at it, it's literally, you're like, oh, well, if you took away all that list, you would say, oh, I was perfectly happy. Because basically meditation cures cancer. It cures everything you can think of. It's like, it cures what is ailing you. And really what's ailing you is samsara. It's this this relationship we have with our impure heaps, because that's what we are. So it's kind of cool. It's really cool. So meditation, so that's what Master Kamala Shila is trying to instill in us, this understanding of compassion and this motivation to want to meditate for the sake of all beings. And we should always be meditating at our best time of day, you know? And like, I have my period right now, to be graphic, but I am so tired. It's a tired that I just don't get any other time of the month. And I can't even believe it. And I forget sometimes, but because I was teaching this class tonight, I realized, I was like, boy. As I actually like to, I'll meditate in the morning, short, but I like to meditate at night, but like, not this week. Like, I had to take a nap today. I was studying, and I was like, And this is once a month what happens to me. And as I get older, it gets more intense. I don't think I noticed it when I was up until my 40s. So that's something to consider. We are changing, and so sometimes, like, you know, you have to follow that too, you know, don't just force yourself into like, so like, I'm very glad I've already meditated today, because I cannot wait to go to sleep. And, but you have to be in tune with what that is for you. And then the moon has something to do with it. and the sun. So like when you, I'm going to get into that later. I'm not going to go. It would fit in very sweetly here, but I'm going to put a little asterisk there. So, all right. Okay. So right now we're in the preliminaries, really. We're in this just the first, the obstacles. So knowing your body and where you're at with your sleep and how much sleep you need, and the food that you put in your body makes a huge difference. I mean, whether you have diabetes or not, like what we put in our body really makes the difference. And it's kind of cool because you can, you know, play around with that, you know, and or notice. That's something always cool to put in your journal too. Like notice like how you feel after lunch every day and like note what you ate and like what time you ate and then how you felt afterwards. Because certain foods, don't you notice, they make you feel tired? And then some energize you. And it depends. Like, it depends for me. I know it depends on how much I'm exercising and, like, there's various things. So you can also write that down. Oh, I took a walk today and then I had some carb, you know, whatever. But it makes a difference in your meditation. There are foods that will agitate your mind. And I'm not just talking about the obvious ones, like caffeine and chocolate and that kind of thing. There are foods that you don't know it that actually agitate you. And if you cut out, you'd be a lot calmer. I know this. I forget which foods it is because I'm not eating anything like I do in the States. So I've done a lot of cleanses in my life. And when you pull out all the foods that your body digests, you come to a place where, you know, your body's not working so hard, you know, because I'm just usually taking in liquids. And then you start reintroducing food back in, and like immediately you can tell what, like, oh, that is not good for me. Like, I know that acidic foods like tomatoes just aren't that good for me. Every once in a while it's okay. But like, they don't work for me. Like, they make me sick. Like, today's was great. It was magical lunch today. Because I like when I eat it once in a while, but like, I'm not a tomato person. But you have to know that about yourself. Like, I can even think about tomatoes and get a stomach ache. And, like, that is your body telling you something. Like, it's interesting. I'll guarantee you. And your kids, too. If they're cranky, check what you're feeding them. I have a kind of a rule of thumb. I think it's sugar, wheat, and what's the third thing?
Dairy.
Yeah. Dairy is phlegm-inducing. And so when your body has an excess of phlegm inside it, it's working overtime. Let's just say that much. And sugar is just not good for us. And wheat just isn't produced the way it used to be produced. So like maybe when all of us were growing up, wheat was different. It's different now. So I think a lot of kids are having like adverse reactions to it. I don't think it, I know it. I don't think it, I know it actually. I have to reiterate that. And the symptoms, you'll see symptoms as depression, autism, hyperactivity, and that's why kids in the States, at least, are over-medicated because they're having all these adverse reactions to the food that maybe was okay when we were younger, but it's not okay for the kids that are being born now. And kids, there's huge amounts of kids that have diabetes, and there's so much intensity in the U.S. as far as kids are concerned. And that's, you know, I look at that and I go, wow, you know, well, that's what Lobsang Chuki Gyaltsen was talking about in the text. What you put in your body makes a difference to each of us. Like, it's different. But it's good to know that, especially, it's really good to know that. Food allergies. People don't talk about it. It's like the hidden thing that people don't talk about. I bet it's probably what causes a lot of people's problem and then they need homeopathy. They could just be cutting out certain foods. Food. All right. That's why it's always best to grow your own foods too and eat fresh and natural. See, I don't see that as such a big deal here in Germany. I think that's the big difference. We eat a lot of packaged and processed foods in the U.S. So there's a lot of additives. I don't.
God, no.
But, all right, so you should meditate at your best time of day and then structure everything else around that. Like, that's just it. So most of us, we finally sit down to meditate, and then we lose the object of meditation. The mind goes, zoop, and then we're constantly bringing it back. So that's the second part, is pulling the mind back to the object. You know, the mind likes shiny things. It likes shiny, attractive things that aren't whatever it is that you're putting in front of it. And, you know, it's very attracted to what it's going to do after meditation. it's funny how exciting the world seems like it's going to be when you're sitting in meditation. The world seems very exciting after your meditation. You know, you're sitting in meditation. My mind is always going to what's going to happen after my meditation. I just think it's just kind of funny. So it's attracted to that. Even though then the meditation's over and it's just life as usual. It wasn't like anything. So this is it? So this is what you were so excited about? It's like, what? So you have to get into this mindset that you need to be strict with your mind, like you are with a dog. You know, there's lots of dogs in this neighborhood. And, you know, it's funny, that's why I never wanted a dog. I didn't like saying no. Because you have to say no to a dog all the time, just like you do with little kids. But now I find that I have to do it with my mind, so I couldn't get out of this. So it's like you have to train your mind like you would train anything else. You know, I mean, you train kids not to cross the street, you know, before looking both ways, and you train your dog not to go to the bathroom in the house and not to bark all the time, I guess. I don't know. I don't know if you can actually train a dog to do that. It's funny. You tell dogs to be quiet. They have this natural instinct, you know. So, human beings are just sensitive about noise, I guess. But we get off the object and we need to train our minds to come back. And that's the biggest thing. Remember I've told you in this class we're supposed to pat ourselves on the back and be really happy that we come back to the object? It's because that is such a good thing. Like, you've just done what you're supposed to do, and that's why it's so important. All right, so you have to come back onto the object when you've gone off the object. You need to train yourself in doing that. And you have to, this is what Lama Christie says, you have to develop a new personality that pulls the mind back when it's misbehaving. So develop a new personality. I thought that was interesting. So, because now you're a meditator, so now you have to take on the personality of a meditator. And a personality of a meditator is somebody who trains and says, no, come back. So when you're getting off the object regularly, you have to learn and you have to figure out how that happened. Like, what was the thing? What maybe it's like 2 minutes into your meditation it happens, or 6 minutes in, or 12 minutes in. But what was the thing that brought you, what thought brought you off the object? You know, and you kind of want to observe that to find out what thoughts are bringing you off your object to bring it back. So Lobsang Chukyi Gelson says, once we've managed to sustain concentration for a short amount of time, then we have usually a problem of dullness and agitation. And this was when we get into the nuts and bolts. So there's two gross forms of dullness and agitation, and the reading is really brilliant. So I highly recommend doing the reading. And it's short. Like I always tell you guys, it's a really short reading, but it goes into detail about dullness and agitation. There's many different kinds. So there's the gross form of dullness, and that's called fogginess. And that's like when you feel half asleep. You know that heaviness that you feel? It's like you're not quite awake, and you haven't gotten enough sleep. And like too much food can induce this. Like if you eat a bunch of food before you meditate, you will most definitely have this. So if you're hungry and you know that all you'll be thinking about in your meditation is food, that's fine. Eat something first, but don't eat like a bowl of pasta. You know, eat something that's going to curb your appetite until you're done meditating. So preferably something light. All right. So he says if you've just had a mental affliction, your mind can get stupid. So your mind can get this fogginess. So to pull up out of the fogginess, we want to think of something really joyful in our lives. You know, a rejoicing meditation will pull you out of your fog. Like, if this is your time to meditate, and, you know, this is all you got, so think of something joyful. You know, something that brings some kind of laughter and joy to your heart that always, like, can get you out of the fog, you know. And by thinking about how lucky you are and all the good things in your life, you know, because it's real personal. And it's not like you're not thinking about somebody else's pain and all that stuff. You're really just pulling yourself up out of this fog with, like, some real thoughts of, like, joy and happiness. And he says a lot of times fogginess goes with depression. So that's interesting. So the opposite of this is restlessness. So this is when you're moving around a lot. Like, I get this a lot where, I mean, I go in phases, but where I'm meditating and I just don't feel like sitting there anymore. You know, like, I just want to get up. I don't know why this happens to me, but it does. And, you know, I just have to, you know, I'm just in a phase and I have to. But this is what restlessness is. So you want to get up. You want to just the half an hour to be over, you know. And it's a specific feeling of wanting that half an hour to be over. It's not even like a distraction thing. It's like that's all you can focus on. And this just simply happens because you forgot why you're meditating. So this is why it's important. Like, I like to, if I forget to do my preliminaries first, which is my inspiration of why I'm meditating. So it's like what we've been talking about, like, so you think about why you're meditating before you actually go into your meditation. So this is what he's saying is the antidote to that. So your mind is just off and running on all its list of things that it has to do, and it doesn't want to sit. So really you have to go into why you're meditating. So you really need to, I think you need to formulate that way before you go sitting on the cushion. You know, this is the kind of thing you need to contemplate in your daily life. And this is what? Okay, so then we go into gross dullness. And this is when your mind is on an object, but your mind feels, you know, dull. What he's saying here is your mind doesn't have any clarity or any brightness. So there's this thing where we want our mind to be clear and bright and steady. So there's the happy medium. But usually it's too bright and we're agitated, or, you know, or we're dull and we're tired. So we're trying to pull our mind into the middle. All right, so we've got this gross dullness. Gross means, like, really, it's a very manifested, it's not subtle, because then we go into subtle dullness. So there's gross dullness and gross agitation. So this is dullness. Your mind feels dull. There's no clarity or brightness. So an example of when this is not happening in your regular life is when you're watching a movie and you're completely and utterly fixated on it. Right? You're totally in the moment, your mind is super clear, and it's super bright. It's amazing. So think about that. Like, what's the last really good movie that you saw? And remember that feeling of clarity and brightness. And how it wasn't agitated at all, because it was just focused in the present moment. So it didn't know what was coming next, but you were focused. It's the same thing. So you have that fixation and clarity on the object. All right. So they call it clarity imbued with intensity, and that is the goal. All right. Then there's gross dullness, and this is when the object isn't clear. No, that was gross dullness. Now we're on to, wait a minute, where's gross agitation? All right, I'm just going to keep going because it's in your reading, so if I skip it. I mean, gross agitation is simply just completely being not wanting to sit and meditate, so you really do. The antidote is thinking about why you're meditating. Okay, so then we go into subtle dullness. So that was gross dullness, and now subtle dullness. This is when the object may be clear, but there's no passion. So you can be sitting there on your object and not move, but there's, like, just blandness. It's like a blah. So it's easy to space out on your object. So you think you're doing good because you're on the object, but you're not, because you're spacing out. So the mind is going through the motions, but that's about it. And the scriptural antidote for this is to focus on the object more tightly. So this is where the object is too loose in the mind. So you want to tighten it up. So if you have any emotional feeling towards the object, you can pull up an emotion that you have towards the object to bring up some passion towards it and some clarity. And if you're so bored with the object that you can't pull any emotion or anything, you should just find another object to meditate on. That's the antidote. And that's okay. You know? So,
So it's important to pull this emotion because for me it's most of the time hard to really visualize in bright colors my meditation object. But I can get in contact by emotion. So this is...
That's fine. Okay. Yeah, but then don't let the emotion become your meditation. The emotion is only supposed to be an... You get the emotion and then you're on the object again. Mm-hmm. So you can see how that would work.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, definitely bright colors is not always the antidote.
Mm.
No. Because then you're just... It's not. But the emotional... I mean, sometimes it works.
Mm-hmm.
One of the is you would focus on a bright color when you have dullness. I think it's under subtle dullness. I haven't gotten to it yet. So let me go into gross agitation. All right, so that was gross. Oh, I see how I had it in my notes. That was gross dullness and subtle dullness. Now we're going into gross agitation. So the mind is simply flying off the object. I mean, it happens all the time. You're focusing on an object, somebody's making noise in the room, you start thinking about the person making the noise in the room. I mean, and then there you go. You're off. You're off on a bunch of other ideas. And again, I already told you, the antidote is recalling why you're sitting there. Okay, subtle agitation. Your mind is on the object, but it's not staying and moving on the object. It keeps shifting. So... it's equated like this. Subtle agitation is like a river that's frozen on the surface, but the water is flowing underneath. Can you kind of get a sense of what that's like? That's subtle agitation. Yeah, there's agitation happening. There's something moving underneath your concentration. So the antidote is relaxing your hold on your object. So this is what was happening to me. So I needed to relax my hold on the object. I was holding it way too tightly. And it was amazing. It was actually just the realization that I was doing that actually relaxed my mind. And then it shifted my whole meditation practice. And it's never been the same. It actually is amazing. So the first Panchen Lama says that your mind, when your mind is dull, you want to uplift it, right? But then when you uplift it, it gets too agitated. So then you have to bring it down. So you have to figure out in your own meditation how much you have to lift yourself and how much you have to bring yourself down. So you're always looking for that measure, you know, that key that will help you with your meditation. And it's really important because that's really what meditation is. It's this balance between agitation and dullness. All right. And then there's this point, this is not going into great detail, there's this point where you have to know when not to make any adjustments. Ha! Alright, so your meditation homework is to look at your activities of the day as you're going through the day. So then sit in meditation and go over your activities of the day and see which ones are bodhisattva activities. And then if one particular activity that you do during the day appeals to you, you can focus on that. And that's your meditation for 15 minutes. And then the second meditation is focus on your breath for 15 minutes. And you could do the breath one first. You don't have to do the Bodhi. You can do either one. But definitely focus on your breath for 15 minutes. And they say it's the easiest way to detect the dullness and the agitation is focusing on your breath. Now, and the breath is hard to focus on, so you find some emotional attachment to it or good reason that you should be meditating. Okay, so now we're not doing any more meditations today. I'm just going to go over the Hatha Yoga Pradipika. So we talked about so the Hatha Yoga Pradipika is made up of these eight limbs of yoga. We've got the yamas and the niyamas, and we've talked about the yamas. Those are the things that purify us, right? And like self-control, right? The things that... Okay, so now we're on the second of the eight limbs, which is the niyamas, and those are the commitments. And there's 10 of those, just like there's 10 yamas. So I'm just going to go over it quickly because this is actually last week's class, because for obvious reasons we stopped. Tapa. Spiritual hardship or making sacrifices for your practice. This is a good one because a good example of this is like you want to sleep in, but you have to get up and do your meditation because if you don't do it then you're not going to have any other time during the day. Spiritual hardship. The great thing about tapas or spiritual hardship is that it's what's letting you know, your mind know, what you think is important. This is what I consider one of the most important aspects of this whole path is tapas. It's the spiritual, it's making the sacrifices. This is when I'm literally telling my mind, this is important. That plants some humongous good seeds, or negative. Okay, the second one is santosha, one of my favorite words. It means contentment. So it's being happy with whatever you get, right? And this is like a real important thing. You know, we're always wanting more in this life. But what about just being content with everything that you already have? You know, you don't need any more anything. I mean, if you need it, you know you need it. And then you just get it. It's no problem. But it's the constant wanting and the desires. So, santosha, contentment. Okay, astikyam. Belief in higher things or putting your mind in a state where you'd want to know why. So, not being content with just living your life and not having the big answers, you know. Believing that there's higher things and then seeking them out. All right, dana, giving. We already went over that, so I'm going to move on. Ishvara pujanam. Pujanam means to honor or worship, and Ishvara means your lord or your master, and it can also be a word for guru. So it's honoring your teachers, basically. The next one is Siddhanta, and this is specifically studying the different schools' views of emptiness. Vakya Shravanam is listening to teachings or about emptiness or any spiritual teaching. Srimati, Srimat is a sense of shame or modesty. So they say that you can't hear a teaching unless you have modesty. So you can't actually collect goodness from a teaching you're not hearing. These are all the collecting of the goodness things I meant to tell you. So you can't collect the goodness from going to a teaching unless you're open and not closed down. Japa is the next one. Reciting mantras. So like Om Mani Padme Hum. If Amma's giving you a mantra, anybody, if you have a mantra that you recite. So reciting mantras is a good way to collect goodness. And hutam, performing a fire offering. So if you want to have an understanding of the fire offerings, you can come to my fire puja at the end of January. You can see how this is all collecting goodness if you look at them. So bhakti yoga is all about serving others, right? It's getting us to a state of realizations. You know, and if we have blocks in our channels, see, now we're into the yoga stuff. And if we have blocks in our channels, then we're not in an optimal place for doing any purification or building of good karma. So these practices are helping us to clear the channels, the blockages in our inner body. So he says, she says, he says, The yamas and niyamas together incorporate the four of the six perfections. We've talked about this before. And the this is how they all are, like, intertwined. Like, these are the same. It's not, they're not, they literally are the six perfections, but in a completely different path. It's not like the two teachers got together and said, oh, hey. It's like two totally separate religious paths for the most part, and they're completely the same. But they all lead us to a state of being able to have a mind that concentrates, and that leads us to that state of wisdom. And this, I feel like we talked about this already, so I'm just going to keep going. I'm going to go on to this class. So this class moves up to the next of the eight limbs. So we've gotten the yamas and the niyamas, right? And now we're up to asana. And asana is, it can translate into the word seat. And, you know, usually we think of yoga as, and asanas as a series of poses that we go through to help clean our channels. So basically ancient yogis came up with a series of poses that would help us get to single-pointed concentration faster. And we use our outer body to catapult ourselves into this state faster. That's what Geshe-la calls it, as banging the pipes from the outside, you know. So that's what Tibetan heart yoga is all about. It's about using the outer body with the mind at the same time to get to the state of single point of concentration quicker. So asana is what is going to help us. Well, one, it helps us to sit in meditation for long periods of time. But two, also, we're putting our bodies into these postures that are allowing the chi or the prana to flow in a smoother way. So, like, we do twists, you know, and we're just kneading the dough, really. And it's not just yoga. It can be tai chi. Geshe-la is a real proponent of ballet being a great practice for this. So you're not just pigeonholed into yoga, you know, and like Lama Murtha's a runner. He likes to run. So he, now that he has all these teachings, he says he thinks about his channels while he's running. But that's his happy place. He likes to run. But any sort of physical exercise that's going to get us moving and getting the channels, the prana and the channels flowing, walking is a great exercise, a pranic exercise. All right. So the way that we put our bodies in meditation is like a mudra. That's what this is. It's a mudra. And so all asana postures are mudras. We're literally putting our bodies into a posture. And there's a certain amount of energy that's going to get to certain places because of where we're putting our bodies. And yogis could feel this. They figure this out when they put themselves in these optimal postures. So you're no different. You can put yourself into a posture and come up with the optimal position for yourself. Because we don't want to be sitting in pain while we're meditating. And if you look in your reading, it goes over very specifically auspicious pose, Gomukhasana, Virasana, Padmasana, this is lotus pose, hero's pose, easy pose, Siddhasana, half lotus, and it gives like the specifics, and these are all the seated postures that are working. They have you put your heel in very specific places because it's stimulating the prana and the sexual organs to move up into the body, right? Because it's prana, and then we're working with that prana. So it's pretty cool. I love the Hatha Yoga Pradipika text. It's very cool. So now I'm going to talk to you, the very last thing, we've just got a few minutes left. One thing I'll say is looking up at the third eye. The third eye is between the eyebrows and back about an inch and a half. If you go to the bump at the roof of the mouth, and if you go straight through the middle of the eyes and then up, where those two lines meet is approximately where that third eye is. And it's a method for getting sharper in your meditation. So if you're having habitual problems with dullness, then you can wake the mind up by bringing your attention to this third eye. That's mm-hmm. what they say. All right, so then the different times of day. So dawn, that's when your mind is clearest and sharpest, right? And they say that you can, I mean, this is not for everybody, but generally speaking, at dawn, your mind is the clearest, and it has the ability to focus on an object in its easiest way. And then in the afternoon, the mind is naturally busy at work, so that's a decent time to do an analytical meditation, you know, because an analytical meditation, like we've done in this class, is more busy work. It's like you're not really focusing on one object. You're having a conversation, a debate in your mind. So afternoon times are fine for analytical meditations. And in the evening are good for elaborate visualizations because your mind gets more creative in the evening. So like visualizations are good that have like, I don't know if you guys have ever done any big visualization meditations, but like Tantra is all about visualization meditation, so they're very good for at night because your mind is in this creative space. It's also feminine energy at night. So basically, we're made up of male and female energies, and one of those is rising at any particular time. There's always one rising and ascending. It's like this, and eventually they come into union with each other. But up until that point, you know, we use the movement of the sun in the sky and the moon in the sky. It's kind of cool. You should jot it down in your notebook. And also, the air is flowing easier out of one nostril than the other all throughout the day. And the right nostril is the male energy, and the left is the female energy. So if you want to know like which energy is more stimulated, and that's hard for me to tell sometimes because it's pretty subtle. And when they come into union, they're going to be perfectly the same. All right? So it says at sunrise and sunset, there's an equaling of the winds of the male and female energies. So I was in my meditation, what's it called? Retreat. I don't meditate. I make sure I'm not meditating at midnight, sunrise, sunset, and noon, because the winds are very agitated at those places. Can you imagine? It's a peak of time on the planet. So that's when your winds are flowing pretty intensely, so it's hard to focus on your meditation object. It's kind of cool. It's nothing like doing my practice and I'm like, shit. All right, so we are done with tonight's class. Like I said, the reading goes into the different seating postures so you can get a deeper understanding of heels and energy. Okay. Oh my God. Okay. Here is the great earth, filled with the smell of incense, covered with a blanket of flowers. The great mountain, the four continents, wearing a jewel of the sun and moon. In my mind, I make them the paradise of a Buddha and offer it all to you. By this deed, may every living being experience the pure world. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Gandhi Yatayami. By this deed, has a start?
By the goodness.
Oh, by the goodness. You guys are reading it. I have this one I forget mm-hmm. sometimes. By the goodness of what I've just done, may all beings complete the collection of merit and wisdom, and thus gain the ultimate two bodies that merit and wisdom make. Okay, thank you for coming.
Thank you.
I think we're all a little bit sleepy tonight. The moon is, see, the moon is in a funky place in the sky, isn't it? Where is it?
Tomorrow is the full moon.
Tomorrow. See? Oh, see, here's my perfect storm. In 1 week of giving up coffee, my moon cycle, it's full moon. How much can one person take?
But it's funny. It is my observation that when the sun goes down or up, mm-hmm. the wind is really agitated. It is, you can observe outside the wind.
Yeah, that's when the wind comes up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny because there's a great stillness that happens in the mornings before mm-hmm. the sun comes up. I used to work with a guy who did hot air balloons, and so we would be up before the sun because that. You don't want wind when you have a hot air balloon going up.
Mm.
And it's amazing what happens on the planet, right? Like, it's funny. Unless there's a huge storm, mostly it's very calm before the sun comes up. It's like the pressure, it has to do with barometric pressure because when the sun, you know, but then as soon as it comes up and then there's some heat from it, it causes, that's when all the winds are stirred. It's amazing. Who would have thought that a job working as I was a balloon, what do they call me? It's a balloon chaser. I was the one, I got to drive the truck, actually, and chase the balloon because we wouldn't know where he was going to land it. And then we broke down the balloon and wrapped it up and everything. And that would be related to my yoga practice. But I know for sure, I did this job for like, I don't know, I think I did it for 2 summers because I was cool. I've always had these weird, quirky jobs because it only lasted a couple of hours, you know? Because but I was up before the sun and I loved it because I had my whole day free and I already made some money and I hung out with my friends. And he ended up creating a barge on the lake and taking off and landing the balloon on Lake Tahoe. It was amazing. This guy was, he invented it himself. He bought a military boat, rented a warehouse and welded this thing to have arms that came in and out because the balloon is so big. I mean, how did I even know? I was so young. I was in my 20s. I was working for a genius. He was a genius. He made so many people happy. You know, so many people happy. It's Lake Tahoe in Northern California is one of the most beautiful places on earth.
See it from the sky.
Okay. How do you say, bit something. That would be see you later?
No,
Now I can say this space. I can even spell it, and now I can use it. My German is coming along. I admit, one of these days I'll be just exactly what you're talking about. And